We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
And good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. During his lifetime, Barnum Brown was one of the most famous scientists in the world. He was a fossil hunter. He was also an oil man. He even spent some time as a spy. Now, today, he is chiefly remembered by his fellow paleontologists, but everyone will recognize the name of his most famous discovery, Tyrannosaurus Rex. This morning, we'll hear more about the man who discovered T-Rex as we talk with Dr. Lowell Dinges from the American Museum of Natural History in New York, where he is research associate in vertebrate paleontology. He is a dinosaur paleontologist. He also has a job with the Museum of Natural History, that is the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County, in addition to the one there in New York. He does a lot of speaking and lecturing on this subject. He's written many articles that have appeared in various scientific publications, also Natural History Magazine, and he has authored a number of books about dinosaurs, both for children and for grown-up readers. And he is also the co-author, along with Mark Norell, who is has the chair of paleontology at the American Museum of Natural History. They're the co-authors of a recent biography of Barnum Brown, and that's the title, Barnum Brown, The Man Who Discovered Tyrannosaurus Rex. Now, the book's recently come out, University of California Press, the publisher, if you'd like to read about the man. And as we talk this morning, of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455 is the Champaign Urbana number. We have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And we also have an email, so you can send along your questions that way, will-talk@illinois.edu. And Dr. Dinges, hello.
Hello, good morning.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us today.
It's my pleasure.
I think that I'm always happy to have a conversation like this where I'm discovering someone who, as I said, in his time was very famous, and I'm sure for people in your field, he remains famous. And yet for the rest of us, well, you know, everybody knows about T-Rex. Nobody knows about Barnum Brown. So I'm really happy to become acquainted with him.
Well, exactly. It's a little over a century ago that he made his discovery of Tyrannosaurus Rex, and kind of ironically, that animal has survived in the public's mindset much more successfully than the man himself who discovered it.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. I think one of the reviews that I read of the book actually made this very interesting point that when you go to a museum and you see a dinosaur skeleton, there are two stories really here. There's the story of the animal itself, but then there is also the story of the discovery. And behind that specimen, there was a person who found that and who uncovered it and who took care of it and who put it back together and who made it possible for there to be it to be there on display. And I think that those stories, as I say, unless you're in the business, those stories, for most people, they never hear those stories.
Well, exactly. And people who do search for dinosaurs, whether it be in the past or today, go into these enterprises and expeditions with particular goals in mind. Every trip kind of has an agenda. You're going out to look in an area where you think you're going to find fossils that will help you with some research question that you're interested in. And this was the case when Barnum went out to East Central Montana in the Missouri Breaks to look for dinosaurs, and it remains true today for expeditions that travel around the world in order to look for fossils.
Yeah, and as far as his significance, I was really struck in more than one place reading about the fact that if you go to your museum, you go to the museum in New York, and you walk through the halls and you look at some of the most important specimens there that they're on exhibit, and an enormous number of them were found by this guy.
Absolutely. He and a couple of assistants that he took with him to the field were terribly successful, and I think it's pretty well recognized and agreed to that he amassed the largest collection of dinosaur skeletons of any man alive, or today even. So his mark on paleontology not only extended throughout the 20th century, but many of the animals that he discovered and the geological notes of the places that he looked for fossils still inform and trigger research questions that we're still following up today.
Yeah, I think also you make note of the fact that, in fact, during his career as a fossil hunter, he found so much material that there are actually still boxes of stuff that have yet to be unpacked.
Absolutely. The goal of an expedition is to bring back all the specimens that you can in terms of ones that are going to be scientifically important for research. And, of course, the other aspect is specimens that will be good for public exhibition. So over the course of his career, I believe he sent back more than 1,200 crates of fossils from all over the world, not just dinosaurs. He collected a lot of fossil mammals also. So his breadth and the scope of his collecting projects over the 50 years or so that he was associated with the American Museum was really extraordinary.
Well, for him, you sort of get the impression, reading about him, and this is not to take anything away from him as a scientist, but it seemed that for him, finding the material was almost more important than anything else, almost more important than classifying, writing about it, writing scientific papers. It was the quest that was the thing that excited him.
Absolutely. He grew up in the area around Carbondale, Kansas, below Topeka, and he grew up on a homestead, basically, and the rock layers that made up the homestead, they would try to scrape for coal, and in the process of doing that, he discovered fossils of seashells and other invertebrate animals, and this triggered his interest. So he really was a child of the frontier, and he never lost that love of the outdoors that he garnered from his experiences as a child. And those experiences also provided him with a wealth of knowledge of how to handle heavy machinery and how to work with large crews. And this just carried him through his whole career. He absolutely did love to be in the field more than in the museum doing the research, although he did a lot more than is generally acknowledged by the modern paleontological community in terms of his research. But there's no doubt that his first love was being in the field and finding the fossils.
Yeah, it sounds like if you read these stories of his childhood and the fact that this kind of thing was so, it was in his backyard from the point that he was a little boy, so it was almost as if he was born to do this kind of work.
Well, he certainly had the native interest, and he also gained so much experience in traveling around the countryside and in dealing with the local people in that kind of environment that he would work, out in remote areas, that these skills and these experiences that he garnered as a child really fueled and set up his career for the rest of his life. He was just very much at home dealing with the locals and socializing with them, and he was also very experienced in moving large objects and things like that. So these all played into his success as a field collector.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Lowell Dingus. He's a research associate in vertebrate paleontology at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. He's also has a job at the Natural History Museum of L.A. County. He's a dinosaur paleontologist, has done a lot of writing and speaking on this subject. He's written books about dinosaurs for children and also for grown-up readers, and he is the co-author of a recently published biography of this man here we've been talking about. His name was Barnum Brown. He's the man who discovered Tyrannosaurus rex. And among paleontologists, he is, in the words of our guests, almost universally recognized as being the greatest fossil collector of all time. Some of the most important specimens there at that museum in New York, which is known for this kind of thing, were things that he and people working with him found. A really interesting story. And questions are welcome. In fact, we have somebody here who is ready to go. Others are certainly welcome to call if you'd like to talk with our guest. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. 800-222-9455. And you may also email your questions and comments to will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a caller here who'd like to join in the conversation, someone who is listening in Indiana on our toll-free line right here, line four. Hello.
Hello. Two things. One, I'd like for you to talk a bit about the naming of the bones when they were put together or whatever, however that sequence is. In relationship to his time and relationship to now that we have, you know, oodles and oodles of neutrino machines and everything else to check stuff. And secondly, which is sort of a subset of that one, I have a vision of this man going out and being in the valley and say, over there, dig. And people dig and all of a sudden their bones are popping up everywhere. What kind of skills or innate things did he have that made him the way he was that he could find those things? I presume quickly and faster than others. And then the other question, of course, is with the substantiating the claims about the bones and stuff. Is it any different now than it was then, or is it still sort of eyeball to eyeball kind of stuff? Thank you.
Okay.
If I understood your question correctly about the naming of the dinosaur bones and the skeletons themselves, it's there are a series of scientific rules that lay out how you go about describing a new genus or a new species of dinosaur, and basically they're called the International Code of Zoological Nomenclature. And what you have to do in terms of trying to establish a new kind of dinosaur is demonstrate by your comparison of the shapes of the bones that it's unlike anything that's been previously found. And then you give the dinosaur a name, the genus name, like Tyrannosaurus, which is capitalized and italicized, and then the species name, Rex, which is italicized but not capitalized. And usually these names have something to do with either an anatomical characteristic that the animal has, or the place where it was found, or a new species can be named after an individual that you want to honor. In terms of Tyrannosaurus rex, the name basically means tyrant king of the dinosaurs or of lizards, depending on how you interpret saurus. And the other question was what now?
Well, there was a question, and this actually was one of the things that interested me as well, how it is you end up finding the dinosaurs and whether, in fact, it's a matter of there having been some natural weathering so that the bones are actually exposed and they're there and you can just see them if you know what you're looking at, or that actually you do have to do some excavating. And there you would wonder, well, how, you know, why is it that you would choose one place over another place if you actually are having to dig something up?
Absolutely. Yes, and you kind of described the two processes that are involved in collecting dinosaurs or other fossils. The first activity is called prospecting, kind of like a miner going around and looking for ore bodies in the remote badlands and mountains and so forth. Paleontologists basically do the same thing when they're starting out searching in an area for fossils. They walk around the hills and the ravines and look for little fragments of fossil bone that are weathering out of the hillside. And you kind of have to pay attention when you do find those kinds of fragments as to what the rock layer is like that you're finding those fragments in, because the rock sequence, the sequence of rock layers, is kind of telling you where the fossils were preserved. Were they preserved in sandstone? Were they preserved in shale? Were they preserved in coal beds or whatever? And so you try to tune your eye to where these fossil fragments are coming out and follow those rock layers around the countryside in order to see if you can find material other than the little fragments that you've found. Now, when you find some fragments weathering down a slope, you kind of trace the trail of fragments up the slope to where you don't find anymore, and you figure that's about where the specimen is weathering out of. And then you begin to brush the loose dirt and sediment off the surface to see if you can find more of the skeleton buried in the ground. And if there is more of the skeleton, then you begin the second process involved in collecting big fossils, and that's called quarrying. So you simply excavate a large quarry following the bones of the skeleton into the hillside until you've exposed as much as you think is there. And then you go through the process of digging around those bones, covering them with a layer of tissue or newspaper, and eventually placing plaster bandages over the bones, much like a doctor would place a cast around a broken arm or a broken leg. And that provides a hard covering to keep the bone in place and all together for when you have to transport it back to the museum. So there really are two aspects of looking for especially big dinosaur fossils, and those are prospecting first, just to find out where the fossils are, and then when you find one, going through the process of excavating it from the quarry. Mm.
And just real quick to follow up on that point about this, the business of using the plaster wraps as a way of keeping protecting the fossil material until you get to wherever it is you're going to do your analysis and reconstruction. Barnum Brown, he was the guy who developed that technique.
Well, it's interesting. He thought he did. And I think he did introduce it to the American Museum of Natural History. But in doing the research for the book, we discovered that a few of the collectors from way back in the 1870s that were collecting for earlier paleontologists like O.C. Marsh at Yale and E.D. Cope at Philadelphia had also developed very similar procedures for jacketing fossils. So, and some of them used plaster as part of that process. So it turns out that Brown wasn't actually the original inventor of that process, but he certainly did establish it at our museum, and it's still the way that we collect fossils today.
We are talking this morning in this part of Focus about Barnum Brown, this man that among paleontologists is regarded as possibly the greatest fossil collector of all time. He was the man who discovered Tyrannosaurus Rex, and he is the subject of a new biography. The title is Barnum Brown, the Man Who Discovered T-Rex. And our guest, Lowell Dingus from the American Museum of Natural History in New York, is one of the authors. We're going to take a break here for just a moment. I have a caller we'll get to. If that person doesn't mind waiting, we'll get to him and maybe get to that other question that the last caller asked. We're here doing just a two-day mini fun drive. The reason we're doing it now is that the end of our fiscal year is in sight. It's next week. And that's important to us because we're now raising the money that will pay for next year's programs. And when I say next year, I mean in the next fiscal year, which starts on the 1st of July. So that's why we need to get as much money into the bank in the next few days as we can, because that's what's going to support next year's programming. So we want to take a little time here over the next day or so. Yeah, we're doing this yesterday. We'll be doing a little bit over the weekend to remind people that their support is vital for the strength of WYLL. So now's an opportunity for you to make that call or maybe go online. A lot of people are doing that. You can call us at 244-9455, or you can go online to wellpledge.org and make a contribution. And I'm happy here in studio here to have with me Dave Teal, who is the program director for WYLL-TV, and is here to help me make the argument that it's an important thing for people to do to make that pledge.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, we're coming down to the last few days here. And from what I can see out on the board outside the studio, it looks like we still have about $185,000 to raise. Now, that's not just for WYLL radio, but that's also for WYLL television, online, all of our activities. And, you know, we've made a heck of a lot of progress throughout this month. So, I mean, as insurmountable as that figure sounds, it's not nearly as bad as it, well, yeah, it really, we've really made a lot of progress over this past few weeks, and we'll continue to make a lot of progress, not just during this pledge drive, but through all our fundraising activities over the next few days. What you can do right now, though, to help whittle away that goal is to call 217-244-9455. We're looking for 15 pledges during this program, well, all the way through the 1 o'clock hour. So you can get on board with that right now. And, of course, you know, if you're listening to this online, as a lot of people do, willpledge.org, just pop open an extra browser window, and you can do it that way. It really only takes a couple of minutes, and it's, you know, it's easy to do. And, you know, it's more important than ever right now, because, I mean, as with a lot of institutions, we've been facing kind of a crisis.
Yeah, most definitely, and it has definitely to do with the financial condition of the state.
Yes,
I think we should be very careful we don't want to give the impression that we think that we're the only ones facing these pressures, because obviously it's hitting people all over, but it is certainly hitting us, and that hits our ability to deliver the programming that people have come to depend on. And, you know, as those sources of funding have shrunk, the only place that we can turn is to the audience. And actually, I think we would have to say that's really the way we would like it to be. We would much rather rely on audience support than on government support, because the government support is just not reliable. And amazingly enough, the audience really is so great. And we have people who have been supporting us so generously for so long. And, you know, we can't enough say thanks to those folks. But we also need to reach out to people who, for whatever reason, listen but aren't supporters.
Yeah. Yeah. And I really do want to say that, I mean, I think the listeners and the viewers of WYLL TV have really stepped up this year, and it's been great. It's just that, you know, unfortunately, we're having to make up a very, very large amount of money that we lost from the state. And we've had to make some adjustments in programming and staffing and, you know, like a lot of institutions throughout the state. So, you know, we certainly don't mean to imply that, you know, we're in it alone here. But definitely, it has been tough, and we want to try to maintain as many services as we can as we go into the new year.
All right. Well, again, if you want to make a contribution, 244-9455 is the number to call. 217 is the area code. But more and more people are going online, and if you want to do that, that'd be great, too. Go to willpledge.org. This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening, and we're also happy to be talking this morning with Lowell Dinges. He is Research Associate in Vertebrate Paleontology at the American Museum of Natural History in New York and the Natural History Museum of L.A. County. He is a dinosaur paleontologist, has done the kind of work that we're talking about, has written about it, spoken about it. He's the author of a number of books. He's written about dinosaurs for children and also for grown-up readers, and is the co-author of a biography of this man that we're talking about here this morning, Barnum Brown, the man who discovered Tyrannosaurus Rex. The book's published by University of California Press. Well, and we do have a caller here who's been patient with us. We'll talk with them over in Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. Mm-hmm. I think your guest kind of answered one of the questions I had, in that there were two famous paleontologists that had an ongoing war between each other, and I was wondering what this gentleman's relationship was to it, and it sounds like they came quite a bit earlier. The other question I was going to ask, and it's really not about this gentleman so much, but maybe about the way he went about looking for things. Maybe I'm just naive and don't understand everything here, but it seems to me that most of the dinosaur bones or relics we find are usually in the higher latitudes. You see them like up in Canada and China and places like that, or on Argentina way down south. You don't find too many along the equator. You never find any here in Illinois, but that's because of glaciation. but why don't we find them around the equator so much?
Yeah, let me answer your second question first. It's very true. You've described the pattern that's quite evident in terms of where we find fossils. I was talking about prospecting and walking around the hillsides and looking for fragments of bone that are weathering out. In order to be able to see the fragments of bone on the surface, usually you're working in areas without much vegetation, like the Missouri Breaks there in east central Montana, where vegetation is really sparse on the outcrops. And these gullied ravine ridge topography are called badlands, and they're called badlands basically because it's hard to do anything much agriculturally in this kind of a landscape. But what it is good for is providing areas where there's not much vegetation so that you can see what is weathering out from the rock layers that form the landscape. And if you think of most equatorial areas, they're very heavily vegetated and forested, which makes it much more difficult to try to find the fossils in amongst all the plants and so forth. So that's the reason that most of the fossils that we find are from the higher latitudes. Your first question in terms of the bone wars back in the 1870s, yes, those were the two individuals that really had the personal feud, O.C. Marsh at Yale and Edward Drinker Cope at the Philadelphia Academy of Sciences primarily. And that was back in a time when paleontology and vertebrate paleontology in particular was just beginning to get a foothold as a science within this country. There had been a lot of work done previously over in Europe. But these were two fairly wealthy men that could fund their own crews of collectors that they sent out west in order to collect fossils for them. And their dispute basically arose kind of in part as a turf battle between who could collect where, and also because as the collectors would send the fossils back or as they collected them out in the field themselves, they would kind of have a competition to see who could name these bones first. And so disputes arose as to whose paper was published first when they would both find bones of basically the same kind of animal. And that whole feud eventually erupted in the New York newspapers, and it kind of entangled a number of younger paleontologists that were just beginning their careers. So Barnum came well after this, basically, you know, a couple of decades after this, but he was working with some of the same people who had been involved in that dispute between Cope and Marsh a couple of decades earlier.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thanks. Just to go back also to the question the previous caller asked about ownership, I'm assuming that if a fossil is found on private land, that it is the property of the landowner. What were most of these fossils that we're talking about, were they found on public lands?
Well, they're really wasn't such a distinction back then as there is today. Today, one has to get permits to collect on public land, and you go through governmental agencies in order to do that. If a landowner today owns the mineral rights to his property, then he can contract with private collectors to come in who will pay him a fee in order to collect on the land. Back then, there weren't those kinds of distinctions, really, especially in the more remote areas, which were the places where most of the collecting was done. It really wasn't deeded land back then. So those kinds of legal complications that arise today weren't really a problem for Brown and his colleagues back at around the turn of the century and on pretty well into the first few decades of the 20th century.
Just for a moment, I want to go back to the have you talk about the skills required to recognize that you are actually looking at a fossil. Now, I have this idea, and I'm sure most people have this idea, that if you were walking along and you suddenly saw a giant bone, what clearly was a giant leg bone, for example, you'd know what that looks like, and you would recognize that's what it was. How much of this material is not that recognizable and to the untrained eye simply looks like a rock?
Well, it's true. It's problematic. Fossils from different localities are different colored, sometimes different textures. They'll be petrified with different minerals, so that can be very variable. But you're looking for chunks of rock that have an organic look to them. They'll have a smooth surface, and maybe on the inside they'll have some of the marrow, the spongy bone that we know about from our own bones and bones of animals that we eat and so forth. And so you'll recognize that as being bone, but lots of times the fragments are fairly small. They'll often be a different color than the rock that they're preserved in, sandstone or shale or mudstone or whatever, so that there'll be a color difference. And once you find one, you kind of have a sense, a search image of what you're looking for in terms of color and texture, and that helps you kind of focus your eyes on things that look like that. But you spend an awful lot, and some, you know, you can spend days and weeks at a time not really finding much, just walking around picking up little chunks that you think might be a fragment of bone or a fragment of teeth. So the moments of ecstasy when you do make a good discovery are tempered by the fact that you're spending, you know, 99% of your time walking around just trying to find some fragments that might turn into something.
So when he found that first T-Rex, did he know right away that he had something really special?
He seemed to have. The letter that he wrote back to his supervisor at the museum, they didn't have a name for it yet or anything like that, but he made the statement in the letter that it was a large carnivorous dinosaur not described by O.C. Marsh at Yale, who we've been talking about earlier. And he says, "I have never seen anything like it from the Cretaceous," which means the rocks that are of Cretaceous age, which he had spent a number of years previously collecting in. So he knew he had something very unusual, and his supervisor at the museum certainly agreed. So the bones were in very, very hard, well-cemented sandstone, and they were very, very difficult to work out, to chip out. So it took a lot of time, and they actually went back to the quarry. They made the original discovery in 1902 and shipped the bones back to be prepared at the museum, cleaned up so that they could see what they had. And then they realized it was so important that they went back in 1905 to open up the same quarry again and try to make sure they had gotten all the bones out of it that were in the quarry. So right from the start, they recognized that they had something pretty unusual and pretty special.
Mm-hmm. Over time, I think we've maybe changed our understanding. We've changed our understanding a great deal about these animals and how they lived and what they looked like. Was he instrumental when it came to taking the bones and assembling them and then going from there to making some, doing some thinking about what this animal might have looked like when it had muscles and skin? Was he really important in directing that, and then as a result of that, then how it is that people thought about what these animals must have been like when they were alive?
He played a role. It was really a team back at the museum that was composed of the chairman of the department, Henry Fairfield Osborne, who was Brown's boss and really the head paleontologist there at the museum. He kind of supervised that process, but Brown, with his assistants, the preparators and the assistant collectors that went out with him, were responsible for overseeing the preparation of the bones, and then they would all work together to develop a pose for the mount itself, the skeletal mount. And they basically originally hoped to put two skeletons of Tyrannosaurus in the exhibition halls in the museum, but they eventually realized that they really didn't have a space, because Brown went on after discovering the first one in 1902 and then going back to the quarry in 1905 to make sure he'd gotten all of that. 3 years later, in 1908, he found an even more spectacular specimen, which was the first one that had a well-preserved skull with it, where you could see the shape of the skull and all the teeth and so forth. That's the one that we have on display in our museum now. So they originally planned to mount both of those, but realized that it would just take up too much space, and so they only mounted the one.
We have talked about his enthusiasm for collecting, how important that was, how he's really known as a collector, even, and that he collected so much material that even there are boxes there packed with stuff that he found that are still sitting there waiting to be unpacked. Now, having said all that, you also make the point that in terms of his scientific contributions, there is something important here to talk about, and that is he really contributed a lot to our understanding of dinosaurs and how they fit into the picture of life, and in fact to this idea that we now have, that some people might put it this way, that in fact the dinosaur didn't really become extinct. We still have them in a way because we have birds, and that's where birds came from. And he was important in helping to establish that kind of understanding.
Yes, especially in terms of the specimens that he collected. The paleontologists back in the day recognized that there were a lot of similarities between the skeleton of a bird like an ostrich and the skeleton of these dinosaurs, which weren't birds. And one of the specimens that he collected in below Billings in Montana on the Crow Indian Reservation, an animal that he informally called Daptosaurus, but eventually came to be named Deinonychus by John Ostrom at Yale, played a very key role in the last three, 4 decades in terms of establishing the evolutionary relationships between birds and other non-avian or non-bird dinosaurs. The skeletal similarities are just so striking in terms of, you think of the three-toed foot with one toe kind of pointing backward on a bird, and the foot structure in these meat-eating dinosaurs like Deinonychus and Velociraptor and even Tyrannosaurus are very similar. The bones of these meat-eating dinosaurs are hollow, just like a bird's. In the wrist structure in the arms, the wrist is really built around a crescent-shaped, moon-shaped bone, and you find that in these little meat-eating dinosaurs like Velociraptor and Deinonychus, as well as in birds, which is the way that a bird moves its wing to develop its power stroke. So all of those kinds of anatomical evidence over the last few decades have added up to make us realize that although there are no more Triceratops and there's no more Tyrannosaurids around, nonetheless, we do have dinosaurs because birds evolved from little meat-eating dinosaurs fairly closely related to dinosaurs that we recognize, like Velociraptor and so forth.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Lowell Dingus. He's the co-author of a recent biography of a man named Barnum Brown, a man who, among paleontologists, is almost universally recognized as the greatest fossil collector of all time. Now, people today, maybe most people won't recognize the name of Barnum Brown, but you will know his most famous discovery. He was the man who discovered Tyrannosaurus Rex. And it's a good story here. So you might want to go out and take a look at this book, if you can find it in the bookstore, Barnum Brown, The Man Who Discovered T-Rex, published by the University of California Press. About 5-6 minutes here left in this part of Focus. Questions welcome, 333-9455. 855 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. I think way back at the beginning I mentioned, in addition to his fossil hunting work, that he had done some oil geology work. It sounds as if this was something that he was kind of doing as a sideline, because he could provide some information that would be valuable to the oil companies, and then that they would then underwrite what he was really interested in, which was looking for the fossils.
Yes, indeed. He was trained as a geologist at the University of Kansas, and of course, at his homestead where he grew up, there were layers of coal there in the hillside. So I think early on he was interested in kind of mining geology. His family kind of ran strip mines there on the farm and would sell the coal to locals for fuel. So early on he became interested in that and followed it up with his college education. And in a way, his consulting for oil companies was a way to make more money, quite frankly, than the museum could pay him. And his supervisors at the museum seemed to kind of be all for this, because he would kind of take a leave of absence and go off to Abyssinia, Ethiopia, or down into Central America, or to Cuba, and do these prospecting studies for the oil companies. But while he was there, he always made an agreement that if they ran across fossils, all of those would come back to the museum in New York. So this was a good deal in the sense that basically the museum was getting a collector, a very, very good collector, out in the field for free, essentially, and would reap whatever fossils were recovered during the analysis of the mining claims. Mm-hmm. So it worked both for Brown's benefit and for the museum's benefit and for the oil company's benefit.
Yeah. Another interesting part of his career was that by virtue of his experience traveling all sorts of places to look for fossils, he knew a lot about those places. That was valuable information that could be of interest to the government. And in fact, he worked for the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, which was before there was the CIA, that was the country's intelligence gathering apparatus.
Indeed. This World War II came at a time when he was the museum was setting a retirement policy, and he was reaching that age, and so he ended up retiring in 1942. And soon after, the government was sending out letters to all sorts of scientists who did field work to find out where they had worked and what they had seen around the world. So they sent these letters to the American Museum, all the curators there at the American Museum, and Brown volunteered to go down to Washington, having worked in Ethiopia, Abyssinia, and having worked on the island of Samos and traveled around through Turkey and so forth. He was very aware of that geography, and they put him to work trying to devise some of the invasion plans that were coming up through the Mediterranean into what they called the soft underbelly of Europe. And he spent a year or two helping put those plans together for the OSS and the military.
We're coming down here at the point we have a couple of minutes left. Do you have a sense of and we've talked about the man's achievements and the fact that he discovered a lot of important specimens, and that to this day, if you go to your museum, you will see them, and they're some of the most interesting and most important things there. Do you have a sense, having read about him and looked at his correspondence and seen what people said about him, do you have some sort of sense of what kind of person he was, what he was like as a man?
One gets the sense that he was he preferred being a loner. He preferred being in the field with maybe one or two trusted assistants. Whereas some of the other field crews, like the one the expedition to Central Asia, Mongolia, and northern China led by Roy Chapman Andrews that discovered the first well-preserved dinosaur eggs. That was kind of a cast of thousands. There were many people from the museum as well as a large crew of Chinese and Mongolian assistants assembled for that. Brown approached field work very differently. He would take one or two trusted assistants and hire some locals in the field to help him if he needed work done on excavating and so forth. He really preferred being alone in the field, and this kind of set him apart. He, for example, his first international expedition down to Patagonia, he went down with a couple of paleontologists from Princeton who had been down there before, and they finished up their work in, you know, a few months, and basically he just stayed down there for another year completely on his own, collecting in many of the same localities that his colleagues from Princeton had, but just developing a collection for our museum that would be a sample of the kinds of animals. And he did it on his own, and he really didn't know much Spanish, but he got along with the ranchers down there. It was a kind of a familiar environment, even though the country was different. And he was just very good at operating on his own in the field, which, as we've talked about before, was what he loved more than anything else.
Yeah. You know, we talked a little bit about how the decision was made when they found the T-Rex, how they were going to put it together and mount it. And I think if people think about T-Rex, maybe they've seen them. They originally were positioned in what sometimes has been referred to as the Godzilla position, you know, where it made it look like they were walking upright. And I think in more recent times, paleontologists have thought more about this and thought, for good reason, thought that they didn't walk upright like that. And for that reason, that the specimens that had been mounted that way had to be taken apart and taken care of and then remounted to reflect what it is we think about them now. So that was a project that you actually got a chance to work with. So you have had your hands on this thing that he found and something that is one of the most important dinosaurs that you have there at your museum.
Indeed, it was a very daunting experience because obviously you're dealing with a priceless specimen that basically can't be replaced. So the care that you take in disassembling the existing mount and planning the metal armature that will hold up the bones for the new mount is all meticulously done. It took a crew of about 10 people 2 years in order to do that. And the motivation was really twofold. One, we spoke a little earlier about the relation between birds and these big meat-eating dinosaurs and little meat-eating dinosaurs. If you think of the way a roadrunner runs with its background or with its backbone kind of horizontal to the ground, that's much more like with the tail balancing the front of the body and being used as a counterbalance as it moves. That's how we think these big bipedal or two-legged, hind-legged dinosaurs ran around. And in addition, we find fossil trackways, a series of footprints of some of these large carnivorous dinosaurs, and you don't see markings in the mud where you see the footprints of a tail dragging along the ground. So it seems to provide evidence that most of the time, at least, when they were actually moving, they were holding the backbone parallel to the ground and with the front of the body being counterbalanced by the tail as it moved around on its hind legs.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're here at the point where we're going to have to finish. I appreciate you giving us some of your time and introducing us to a person that you and people in your field certainly know all about, but everybody else should recognize as well. We should know him as well as we know the T-Rex, Barnum Brown, the man who is thought to be one of the greatest fossil collectors of all time, the man who discovered T-Rex. If you'd like to read more of the story, you can look for the book Barnum Brown, The Man Who Discovered Tyrannosaurus Rex, recently published biography from the University of California Press by our guest, Lowell Dingus. He is a research associate in vertebrate paleontology at the American Museum of Natural History in New York and the Natural History Museum of L.A. County. And thanks very much for giving us some of your time today. We appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure.